The World Tomorrow. Garner Ted Armstrong brings you the plain truth about today's world news and the prophecies of the world tomorrow.
And greetings, friends around the world. Do you know that another war in the Middle East could immediately send the entirety of Western civilization into an economic tailspin? And that could happen in any given moment. There is not a day, not a week that goes by, but what you could arise to listen to startling news reports from the Middle East that once again, war has erupted in the Middle East between Israel and her Arab neighbors, or some of the Arab neighbors themselves. Recent warnings from some of the OPEC nations about yet future oil embargoes, as well as all the discussion right now, the meetings that you've been reading about, many nations hanging by their economic fingernails as they wait to wonder whether or not the increases are going to be from 4 or 5%, growing up to 40%, as the OPEC oil ministers hold in their hands the economic destinies of the Western world. Did you ever stop to think of what an incredible turn of affairs it has been since the Yom Kippur War, since 1973, of how this world of ours has become absolutely dependent upon the whimsical ideas of oil ministers of little-known, unheard-of, vaguely recognized nations in the Persian Gulf area that most Americans, including school children, could not locate on a map? I've said for many years that since the explosion of the first atomic bomb, Washington has never made a major foreign policy decision without wondering, first of all, what would be the Kremlin reaction. And now we see major European nations and the United States not daring to make major financial or economic decisions, embark on programs, talk about the economy, without taking into full consideration exactly what Arab oil-rich states intend doing. In the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries, that's what OPEC stands for, Saudi Arabia, with a flood of revenue and a need for some place to get rid of all that money, which of course is why they have invested in some of the major blue chip stocks in the United States, and why increasingly Arabs, as well as Japanese and Germans, own vast slices of U.S. real estate. Increasingly important is Arab investment in some of the major banks, lending institutions, financial organizations, railroads, airlines. I told you a long time ago they may as well add another A to Pan Am. They should call it Pan Arabian American Airlines now, because if it hadn't been for Arab money, Pan Am would have gone down the drain. And so with this flood of money going into those nations, they just don't have enough. Now, we can understand their plight. They want to become as developed as we are. They want to come to the place where their cities are reeking with smog, choked with automobile traffic jams. They want to come to the place where everybody has so much that they have the same unparalleled affluence and the same unparalleled divorce rates, crime, murder, mayhem, arson, robbery, rape, muggings, and all the other social diseases that go with incredible materialism and a wave of affluence. And they're out to get it. They're out to become what they call developed. It's unbelievable, isn't it, to think of nations that you have scarcely ever heard of before who actually hold the key to your future in their hands? Men who are called sheikh thus and such, who may make decisions in the months and the years ahead that will actually control your own personal destiny. In an interview recently with Business Week's Middle East Bureau, with Sheikh Yamani, who is the very influential Saudi Arabian oil minister, he was asked the question, why has Saudi Arabia held back other members of OPEC that wanted to increase the oil price this year? And he said, one reason is our concern with the economy of the world. I thought that was very big of him, thought it was essential, of course, that they understand that. He said, we need a strong economy in the West to achieve our industrial and development targets inside Saudi Arabia, and we do not want a recession in the West that will definitely weaken the present political systems. Listen to those words. I think that's incisive. I think it's very important. Even the Saudi Arabians look with a little bit of fear toward what might develop inside Europe if there should come some terrible shift in the economies of those countries. For many years, I've been warning on the World Tomorrow broadcast that any sudden shift in the economic climate inside Central Europe, particularly in the nation of Germany, since the political parties there exist upon subventions directly from the major industrialists, could bring about a diversion of those funds into very much less savory quarters than present political systems inside West Germany. Here is a sheikh from Saudi Arabia who says, "We do not want a recession in the West that will definitely weaken the present political systems, especially in certain areas in Europe, and would increase the rate of unemployment and bring about, listen to this, bring about a different type of system." Now put that together with the fact that very recently the common market had warned against excessive rises in prices to the OPEC ministers. From The Hague, it was reported in the 1st of December in 1976 that leaders of the nine common market nations warned the oil producers that anything more than a moderate increase, meaning 3-5% or so, which most people think they can live with, anything more than a moderate increase in oil prices would worsen the already deteriorating economic outlook in the industrial world. The common market position was set out in a statement issued after regular heads of government meeting in the Dutch capital. So members of OPEC meeting, and you're reading about the results to discuss price increases, were being warned or wooed, as the case may have been, because of the understanding in many quarters of this world, particularly in the industrialized sections of Western Europe, of what an unacceptable price rise would do. The Sheikh of Araby, in this case the Arab oil minister Yamani, was also asked, "Under what circumstances do you think that Saudi Arabia would use the oil embargo as a weapon against the consuming countries again?" And he said, "I do not rule out that possibility, but I think it is very remote now. And I'm optimistic that under the new American administration, you will be able to move toward a peaceful settlement of the Middle East crisis. You cannot defuse the oil embargo weapon," he said, "except by bringing peace to the area. As long as we don't have peace, that weapon stands ready." So as I said in my opening comment, if at any moment you awaken to read your newspapers or hear over radio or TV that another round of war has broken out in that volatile, unstable Middle East, where we have a very tenuous ceasefire, as it were, for a moment, with a few hundred American civilians manning voluntary listening posts, keeping the Arabs and the Israelis apart in the Sinai, with all that we have seen in the months and months of civil war and strife between Christians and Arab Muslims in the nation of Lebanon, with the potential for eruption of war along that border, the border shared between Israel and Syria, of Jordan, of Saudi Arabia, of Egypt, you just cannot know from one moment to another what will happen. And if war were to come to the Middle East, the Arabs very plainly say that they would once again use what they call a weapon, meaning an oil embargo. Now, back when we first staggered through that icy cold winter of 73 and 74, when then President Nixon urged everybody to turn the thermostats down to 68, put a brick in the water tap of your lavatories, drive less, conserve fuel, get out the heavy coats and the thermal underwear and tough it out, when schools and factories and shopping centers closed down because of lack of fuel, when airlines laid off aircraft, when big cars fell right out the bottom, when some of the RVs and camper vehicles sat on lots and virtually went bankrupt, and when the whole nation began to gird itself for one of the toughest, coldest, longest winters we had ever seen, and we were doing pretty well, we just began to cancel trips. Oh, people got hurt, sure. Filling station operators, resort operators, RV dealers, big car dealers. Sure, there were problems. They said originally we were 11. Then they changed it to 17% dependent. And then they said about 24% dependent. But even the largest estimate you heard doesn't even begin to compare with the fact that since that time we have become more and more dependent upon Arab oil until we are now about 44% dependent. In other words, we are nowhere near so equipped or prepared to withstand another oil embargo, let alone unacceptable price rises, than we were in 1973. Instead of learning the lesson and telling these other nations, we don't need your oil, we'll get along without it. Oh, we heard all those programs, remember? They're probably so far down in a round file, you can't even find the remains of the shredded information anymore about independence, self-sufficiency, becoming self-supportive, producing our own oil, depending upon no foreigners whatsoever by about 1980. Whatever happened to that program? Nothing. It never even got off the ground. That was worth just so much empty verbiage, which rhymes with garbage, which is another form of pollution. Nobody did a thing about it. And so today, we are edging toward 50% dependency for half of our annual national consumption to fuel our industries and heat our factories and schools and public institutional buildings in our homes, to drive our automobiles, you know, the ones built in Germany and Japan. It's unbelievable. But that's the way we're headed. And so, just like Washington has had to keep an ear to the ground ever since the explosion of the first atomic bomb out there in the vastness of the Soviet Siberia, and has never been able to really make an important foreign policy decision without wondering which way will the Russians leap. Now, today, in this time of economic crisis, of joblessness, this time of economic slump and the very desperate need to get the economy moving again, we do not dare take any decisions that we do not listen very carefully first to the Arabs and find out which way they're going to go. It's more than interesting, it's absolutely deadly. So when this Arab oil minister was asked if any circumstances would come along that might cause an oil embargo again, he talked about war in the Middle East, and that weapon stands ready. In other words, he was asked by Business Week, in case of another Middle East war and another air bridge from the United States to Israel, there is the possibility of another embargo. Is this the only thing that would cause it? He said, it happened in the past, and I cannot say that it cannot happen again. Now, even though the Saudi Arabians apparently are going to, as they say, play it cool on this business of a price hike, you've got to remember in retrospect that the Saudis are only one member, even if an influential one, of the oil-producing nations. And there are many other members, and some of them are very volatile indeed. Some of them couldn't care less, except as it might affect their own economies, about stability in the West. 3 years ago, OPEC launched its own revolution. It was a monumental revolution that brought about topsy-turvy conditions and disarray in Western economies by the drove. There has been nothing like it in all of world history that you can search out the history books to find. Nothing like it in all of world history. So that little nations, as I say, virtually unknown, unrecognizable, and most people couldn't even point to them on a map, became almost overnight the richest countries on the world with a higher per capita income of poverty-ridden, poverty-stricken, nomadic desert wastelands with oil underneath those sands, to the point that those nations scarcely know how to get rid of the flow of money. Very few people understand even one little tiny percentage of biblical prophecy and how it leaps to life in the pages of today's world news by showing what is the real meaning of news, trends, and conditions. Where do we go from here? What is the outcome of it all? One of the most interesting, call it one of the most foreboding, if you like, prophecies in all the Bible, and certainly the longest biblical prophecy, is in the book of Daniel, the 11th chapter, where it talks about the time of the end, beginning in verse 40. And it talks about a king of the south. History books identify those struggles that raged back and forth across the Middle East. It seems it has been a timeless exercise that goes back in ancient history so far as any history has ever been kept of wars in that area. But at this time of the writing of these prophecies, there did wage back and forth across the land of Palestine warfare between the Syrian kings, the Seleucids or the Seleucidae, and those Ptolemies, a type of a pharaoh that took the name Ptolemy of Egypt, who was identified in biblical prophecy as the king of the south, Syria, the king of the north. But here is a prophecy which shows that was only typical, that it was only like analogous to what would happen in a time which is described in the Bible as the time of the end. And it said a king of the south would push at a king of the north, who would react with lightning-like tactics of warfare, instantly entering into the Middle East It says, with many ships entering into the countries, overflowing and pass over, and entering into what is called in verse 41, the glorious land, which means Palestine. Now put that together with the prophecies of Christ in Matthew 24, Luke 21, where he gave a several pointed prophecy, a very mysterious sounding prophecy, in which he warned people to be very, very careful about something that Daniel said. He said, "Whoso readeth, let him understand," as if in the first reading you might not understand it, as if you might read right over it and not really get what it intends. He said, "When you see the abomination of desolation," or as the margin has it, the abomination which results in desolation, "standing in the holy place, where it ought not, then know that the destruction of Jerusalem is nigh." The key to that great time described in the book of Revelation, as well as in Matthew 24 and Jeremiah's 30 and 31st chapter, which is called the Great Tribulation, a time of unparalleled natural calamities, of drought, famine, earthquake, and eventual disease epidemics, as well as the round of war that will be the beginning of World War III. The key to all of that is in the Middle East and in the city of Jerusalem, and most specifically, a greater key than even that, is a great religious figure who is going to fulfill that prophecy of Matthew 24, Luke 21, 2 Thessalonians, the second chapter, who is going to fulfill this mysterious prophecy of Daniel of an abominable thing that is absolutely filthy in God's sight, standing in what is called the holy place, where it ought not. Now, no holy place exists except in the broadest application of God saying that perhaps the site of the ancient temple would be looked at as holy. So people have speculated, I have, as to whether or not eventually another temple would be built. Matter of fact, sometimes spurious information is actually circulated around. Some character one day put out some kind of an article in Britain, and a lot of people rushed to the newspapers and magazines and religious pamphlets with it and said, "Oh, it's got to be true," because they saw in biblical prophecy, which is not privy to my understanding, a lot of people can understand that there has to come a great reunion of nations in Europe. There has to come a great super king who is called a beast figuratively in biblical prophecy. There has to emerge a great religious leader who is called the false prophet in Bible prophecy. And they can understand that those two people are going to actually be in the city of Jerusalem at the time of a great climactic world battle. That's not information that I privately understand. It's information that is even being used in various twisted versions of Hollywood devil movies these days, as I think Satan the devil prepares minds of millions of individuals to call the real Jesus Christ the Antichrist, and prepares minds for exorcism under the pretense of beginning to claim that the righteous who are called saints in God's sight and who are said in the prophecies of the Bible to be people who eventually will be persecuted to the point of literal martyrdom. So even today you see Satan the devil beginning to prepare millions of minds of accusing those who have God's Holy Spirit, who are converted and baptized members of God's own church on this earth, to be exorcised, meaning put to death. Because the time will come when those who are doing God's work and have God's Holy Spirit will be looked upon as the filthiest, rottenest, most dangerous threats to national security, to national peace, and to other people around the world. Christ said so. He said, "You shall be hated of all nations for my name's sake." He said, "The time will come when they will persecute you," right inside their religious places. He said, "The time will come when they that kill you will think they do God a service." Now, the only way you can make a religious exercise out of killing somebody is get to be such a spittle-inflected, distended, vain, hoarse-voiced, bug-eyed religious fanatic that you would actually think you are doing God a service to put someone to death because you think he is possessed of the devil, when you don't know that's what's got into you. You know, you could say this is weird. Sure. An awful lot that's going on in this world is weird today. People have begun to accept what is insane as normal. People have begun to think garbage is fit to eat. Swill, slop, perversion, wretchedness, distortion, lies, homosexuality, sadism, masochism, brutality, murder, demonism, demon possession. The spate of devil movies that is in the public eye today, this is supposed to be commonplace. That's supposed to be wholesome, healthy, happy, and good. People go to see that kind of filth, slop, and garbage and don't realize that just as sure as you can take a file and wear through metal, you can also take filth like that and grind away on your conscience to the point you'll come to a virtual animalistic, brutal emotional state to where the value of human pain, of human life, will no longer really enter your mind. Now that's an aside, but it's an important factor right now today as you see that type of thing occurring in the United States of America, of this spate of Hollywood movies of immense popularity, of demon possession. Time was when talk about demon possession belonged in the pulpits of the churches or tent camp evangelism or religious tracts and booklets, and most people would have just ignored that. Now it turns out it's one of the top box office attractions in the United States of America. What you want to do is to go see somebody possessed of about 16 or 19 different demons. That's what people want to flock to see. Well, there's a great deal said in the Bible about a tremendous, furious, unbelievable return to the false religion of demoniacal religion, and that people are going to actually accuse the real Jesus Christ when he does return as being the Antichrist. So if you read anything at all in Bible prophecy, you know that the Middle East is the absolute focal point of Bible prophecy. It is the pivotal part of the earth where biblical prophecies are going to be completed. Now when it says here that a king of the south will push at a king of the north, you have to understand the difference in biblical language between a plain attack, in which it describes, for example, in the same prophecy, an attack being like an overflowing, like an avalanche, like a flood, as opposed to this king of the south who has what? It says in verse 43, treasures of gold and silver, precious things. And it said he will push at this king of the north. You could not have understood that prophecy in its literal meaning until the time in which you live right now. You couldn't have understood it in the Middle Ages, at the time of the Revolutionary War, the Civil War, World War I, or even World War II, really, because even in that time you could not have said that the nations of the Middle East, including Egypt, and some of these other nations around Egypt, would possess great treasures of gold and silver. But what about today, when the wealth of the world is pouring into the Middle East, where the Middle East has a stranglehold in those OPEC oil-producing nations, right around the gullet of the Western democratic nations, the industrialized, developed West? What is this push? What is a jostling, a shoving match internationally, nation between nation, if it is not something just like an oil embargo or unacceptable price rises, if it is not like cutting off the goods or freezing the assets of one country and another's banks, if it is not like a world trade war, if it is not like nationalization of one country's goods by another, the breaking off of diplomatic relations, an oil embargo? Those are jostling, pushing, shoving moves made by one country against another, short of actual armed aggression. But armed aggression is going to result, it says in this 11th chapter of the book of Daniel, and it said he will enter into the glorious land. Now when he does, you put together the prophecy of Matthew 24, that talks about the abomination of desolation standing in the holy place where it ought not. Read in history what that was. First, the sacrifice of a pig inside the very holy place, one of the very main parts of the interior of the temple in ancient Israel. The Holy of Holies was a smaller room inside the holy place, and inside the Holy of Holies, which was a type of God's own throne in heaven, could be found the Ark of the Covenant, together with that sample of manna that was carried out of the wilderness by the children of Israel, the book of the law, the tables of the Ten Commandments. Out in the holy place you could see the showbread, the candelabra. It was a place of daily sacrificing, ministering by the priest during the days of the Levitical priesthood, and even later on clear down to the days of Herod. But when they set up a pagan altar and sacrificed a pig abominable in the sight of the people of Israel during that day, that was perhaps typical of what was yet to come, when Antiochus Epiphanes set up a statue of Jupiter Olympus inside that holy place. I happen to think that statue still exists somewhere, that it's seen by an enormous line of people every single year, but then that's probably just a personal opinion. But it says when that abomination that makes desolate is set up in the holy place, then let them which be in Jerusalem flee for their lives. That's what Christ said. That's in the words of Jesus Christ in the 24th chapter of Matthew. Now, we're living in a time where at any moment another war could break out in the Middle East, which would bring about an Arab oil embargo, which would bring about massive disruptions in the economies of the West, which in turn would bring about jarring, shocking changes in government, which would bring about total changes in foreign policies, which would bring about war. And when that happens, an awful lot of Bible prophecy is going to fall into place in an awful hurry. The only way you can understand all of that is to study it, read it, come to understand what Bible prophecy really says. Now, we have a series of booklets on these mysterious horsemen that are seen to gallop across the heavens in the vision of John in the book of Revelation. I'd like to send you all four of them, but at least you ought to get this one on famine, the black horse. If you'll read in that prophecy, you'll find a white, a red, a pale, and a black horse in the book of Revelation called the Apocalypse. Each one of those horsemen is the subject of a fully illustrated, full-color booklet on the subject of the interpretation which the Bible itself provides, the interpretation of what are those mysterious horsemen of the book of Revelation. It has everything to do with what is happening in the world right now today, with the economies of nations, with the rise in disease and the growth of famine, with the rise of false religions and the emergence eventually of a so-called great false prophet, with wars here and there, and with one great war which is in the making, here a little and there a little every single day. You can have all four of those booklets if you want them by return mail, free of charge. They're called The White Horse, False Religion; The Red Horse, War; The Black Horse, Famine; The Pale Horse, Disease, Epidemics. That's too much to remember, so just remember those four booklets about the four horsemen of the apocalypse. Remember the four booklets about the horses, if you want to, the four horse booklets, because that has to do with biblical prophecy. And if you pick up the telephone and call right now, then you won't forget it. You'll remember those four booklets that show you these major parts of Bible prophecy being fulfilled before your very eyes in your daily newspapers if you will call 800-423-4444. That's 800-423-4444. If you live in Alaska, California, or Hawaii, the number is area 213-577-5225. Or you can write to me, Garner Ted Armstrong, Pasadena, California, for those free booklets. Are absolutely free, no charge whatsoever. Request the current number of the Plain Truth magazine while you're at it. The address again in just a moment. Until next time, Garner Ted Armstrong saying goodbye, friends.
You have heard The World Tomorrow with Garner Ted Armstrong, sponsored by the Worldwide Church of God. For literature offered on this program, send your requests along with the call letters of this station to Garner Ted Armstrong, Pasadena, California, 91123. Or you may dial this toll-free number, 800-423-4444.